I guess we'll go ahead and start there. Our presentation.
The three of us will take about 20 minutes talking a little bit about, Rick's going to talk about monasticism in general, 5-minute course in monasticism, and Eckhart will tell you a little bit about the physical setting at Our Lady of Guadalupe Trappist Abbey in Oregon, where we've all stayed recently, and then we'll each spend a little bit of time, a few minutes, talking about sort of our impressions of the Abbey. And we hope that will fill up no more than about 20 minutes, and then we'll have a brief break where people would like to leave, and then we'll just have a question and answer period of maybe 15, 20 minutes, or if people want to stay longer, we're willing. But we'll try to have it wound up, I suppose, by about 10 or 15 minutes after 9. So I think you're next.
Okay, this is just going to be real brief. What I'm going to explain is just a couple ideas that are related to monasticism. It seems like monasticism really had its roots in about the 4th century, and the founders in many ways have really become a movement were called the Desert Fathers. At that time, the Roman culture was quite powerful and quite decadent, and people were leaving the culture and just going to the desert and becoming hermits, and then communities started to form out of that. And so that, in many ways, was kind of the very beginning of monasticism. The basis, according to Thomas Merton, has some tapes, just fascinating tapes. And in the third tape, and the series is entitled "The Mystical Life," and he says that the basis of monasticism is coming together to live a different way of life than the world. And the community is usually drawn together by a master or a spiritual, almost a spiritual guru in the sense of the Eastern religions. That isn't so much now because of the establishment of the different monastic orders, which three of them, the popular ones, we would be Franciscans, Benedictines, and Trappists. I'm reading from this book called Genesee Diary, by Henry Nouwen. Nouwen spent 7 months in the Trappist Monastery of Genesee. And here I'm reading from, on page 170, the third of November. "The monastery is the center of the world." This drastic statement by John Eudes, who is the abbot of the Genesee Monastery. This drastic statement by John Eudes in chapter this morning reminded me of exactly the same statement made by Thomas Merton when he came to the Abbey of Gethsemane for the first time. The monastery is not just a place to keep the world out, but a place where God can dwell. The liturgy, the silence, the rhythm of the day, the week and the year, the whole monastic lifestyle with the harmony of prayer, spiritual reading, and manual labor are meant to create space for God. The ideal of the monk is to live in the presence of God, to pray, read, work, eat, and sleep in the company of his divine Lord. Monastic life is the continuing contemplation of the mysteries of God, not just during the periods of silent meditation, but during all parts of the day. People who become involved in the monastic way of life, their idea is that they cannot receive enough of the experiential relationship with God through the within the social culture that they live in. That they need more strict a schedule, more strict structure. A definition of the encyclopedia there states that religious institutions and belief systems whose members attempt to practice religious works that are above and beyond those required by the religious leaders of the society and of exceptional religious and spiritual leaders in their society. And so the idea is that in our culture, being a socially good person for certain people is not enough. They want more. And the underlying idea is that the goal is to come into experiential union with God. It's got to be something where God is really a tangible reality. Thomas Merton said, we met a couple monks which really were quite profound. We also, at least Eckhart and I, met one we thought which was just out to lunch. And really, and Thomas Merton said in one of his tapes that a monk who is hiding in a monastery who doesn't really belong there is going to have the lowest place in hell. And Merton talks about there are those kind of people. In the monastic movement, celibacy is the norm, or it's common, but it's not universal. You know, there are third order movements in which people practice the monastic way of life but are married and live in the world. So celibacy is most common, but it's not a requirement. Asceticism, though, where it's really like training, just like we train to be accountants or lawyers or doctors or athletes, the monastic way of life calls for a certain element of asceticism. But that's a healthy definition. It's not purging your body or going through physical tortures. Fasting is an aspect of asceticism. Getting up very early and praying is an aspect of asceticism. So asceticism is a universal requirement of the monastic way of life. Celibacy is popular, but it's not an absolute requirement, because there are third orders in which people, again, are married, they live in the world, but they definitely withdraw. They withdraw.
There's more. Third order, what's first and second?
Well, I don't know what second is. It's a good question. I've thought about that. But first...
Nuns,
okay. And I don't know why. Okay. So I guess what it means is, we'll say there's one and two together, and that they're separate. So there's one order is men, one order is women, and then the third order is where you have, you know, you can be within that order and be married and have family.
Okay. Now I would like to talk about, or give a number of facts on the monastery the three of us went to, and its name is Our Lady of Guadalupe Abbey, and it's located in Lafayette, Oregon, which is about probably 30 minutes drive south of Portland. The landscape there is very hilly and a lot of forest, and the abbey itself is very a very quiet area, let's put it that way. Now, as has used the guest houses, women were accepted only on a daily basis. They were not allowed on the property overnight. Now, if you go there on a retreat, the maximum length is 1 week, and you can go there four times a year for 1 week. As far as the costs go, you're asked to give a donation, and the operating costs are indicated as being $7.50. You will be taken care of by a guest master, and you normally have the opportunity to go on a guided monastery tour where one of the monks will show you the whole monastery. And other than that, there's always the possibility to talk to any of the monks and to receive spiritual guidance or whatever. I think that's it, basically.
Okay, well, I was there probably only about a week before Rick and Eckhart were there. Kind of interesting. Our paths almost intersected. I spent 6 or 7 days there. And it really is a very pleasant place to be. I had what I felt was a good relationship with the guest master, and we had several good talks, the longest of which lasted a good part of one morning on the subject of prayer, all the way from beginning prayer up to the highest forms of prayer. And he really sort of fired my imagination and desire to learn how to pray and be more serious about my prayer life. Spent a lot of time out in the woods too. The wooded hills there are just really lovely, and it's crisscrossed with paths, and I did a lot of exploring, and that was a very good part of my experience there. I also enjoyed interacting with the other guests very much, and in particular, it seems like God has been doing this a lot to me lately. He's been putting me in contact with people who are in the military, and I guess I'm somewhat of a pacifist. And I'm afraid I have certainly my share, if not more, of stereotypes of people who are in the armed forces. And one young man that I met at the monastery was just the latest person to blow away a lot of my prejudices about the sort of people that you find in the military. And I was very grateful for that. And actually, I'm planning, as soon as I get back to Seattle from here, I'm planning on giving that young man a call. He's stationed in Bremerton. I hope we'll have a chance to get together. And he is actually contemplating becoming a monk. So that was a real neat aspect of my visit there. And I entertained the critters in the woods with my dulcimer. That was a nice part of my stay. Sometimes I took my dulcimer out with me. And one morning I helped do some painting on some of the buildings. You're welcome to assist in the chores, the various jobs that need to be done around the monastery. It certainly is not a requirement, not at all, but some people find that it's useful during their retreat to have sort of a rhythm where they work some, then they have time to themselves. I only did that one day, but I enjoyed it. I guess that's all I have to say for now.
So there's a lot more that I think all of us could say, but because of this time factor, we'll be glad to entertain questions right now. People have questions, or those questions, we'll start talking again. So if anybody have any questions about the...
What is the purpose? Why can't you just go for a year? Why do you have to go all your lifelong commitment?
I'm not really sure. The Eastern religions, if you become a monk within the Eastern traditions, you can go to a particular monastery and leave, and you can withdraw. One of the fellows that Eckhart and I visited, a friend of mine who was a Zen Buddhist priest for 5 years down in San Francisco, and he's now dropped out of it. And for some reason, within the Christian tradition, it's for life. And I don't know how. I think that developed about the 6th or 7th century, or 8th century, and I don't know why particularly. You know how, but St. Benedict was the first, he was the founder of the Benedictine monastery. The Trappists came out of the Benedictine monastery, and then the Franciscans were separate from that tradition, but came after that. And I don't know why it developed. Do either of you guys know? But it's 1 year. There was a monk, I think it was with the Trappists, who had dropped out of the order and got married. You know,
as a matter of fact, it was the previous abbot.
What's their attitude? What's their attitude then?
Well, if you're sincere, well, it's assumed you're sincere, you can drop out any time during these first 3 years, and that's fine. You know, the last thing they do is trying to hustle you into the monastery. They want you to leave, they want you to go back, and they want you to be sure. And so, you know, you're there for like four 1 week visits the first year, and you come for a month, and you go away again, and you come back and go for another month. And they're and you can leave at any time. And then if you make a decision to stay for 1 year, so you make that commitment, you stay for the year. If you want to leave at that time, that's perfectly fine. If you want to stay for 2 more years, then you can leave at that time. So they're very open, you know, and they're very cautious on having a person become a monk. And again, it takes 6 years before those decisions are made for a lifetime vow.
One more question. What would be the purpose of going and living in a monastery? I mean, is it all for personal gain, or is it more praying for the world?
I think it's a question of the vocation. If you feel that you have a very intense relationship with God and want to be only with God, then a monastery offers you the perfect environment to have that relationship. And in particular, in this case, Trappist monasteries are looked upon as being contemplative places, as opposed to, let's say, Benedictine monasteries, where people are much more into teaching and to the outward life.
It's called apostolic orders, I think, the orders that have a mission out in the world.
Okay. Do they ever get outside much, or do they basically stay there the whole time? Do they ever get outside and interact with other people, or just the guests that come in?
They go out occasionally, certainly for things like dentist's appointments. It's not completely cloistered, at least not at the Lafayette Abbey. It's kind of, one of the brothers was entertaining his mother and his sister while I was there. They were there for a week. They made an exception to the rule in that case. The mother and the sister stayed in one of the guest cottages. And I believe actually that was Brother John, I think. I think they, Brother John and his family went out actually, I believe, more than once during their stay there, I assume, just to maybe do a little bit of sightseeing or something. So at least at that abbey, it is not a completely cloistered life.
But
I think there is some variation between abbeys, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, but normally, in the case of the Trappist monasteries, monks are asked to leave the monastery only if really necessary, such as, let's say, funerals or perhaps weddings.
Medical problems.
Or health problems.
It must be quite a shock for them to go out and to... Especially if they've been there for a year and things keep progressing so much worse in the world. Have you talked to any of them about how difficult it is for them to maybe relate to the world?
When you say relate, how do
well,
you...
Well, if they ever... Did you talk with any of them who talked about their experience of going outside at all?
No, Eckhart and I got to spend some good time with one of the monks named Mark the Monk. and very insightful. He was 51 years old and could have easily passed for his late 30s. Great sense of humor, some real cynicism toward the American culture, toward the Catholic Church. I mean, I think healthy cynicism. He was very well aware of world problems. He'd started the, I don't know how many people are aware of the fasting that occurs now every sixth of every month in terms of honor or in terms of recognition of Hiroshima. There's a movement now happening throughout the U.S.
It's called Fast for Life.
Fast for Life. Well, he was participating in that. So the monks, like what Thomas Merton says too, if one feels called to the vocation of a monk, it's there not to escape from the world. You really deeply encounter the issues in prayer, in deep dialogue. And I don't think they would really have much problems other than the normal transition thing of going out to the towns or whatever, because I mean, this again assumes a person is really called to be a monk, as the most of the people we met there was, that was really our impression on those.
Could each of you share a little bit of how you feel you've grown personally through this experience?
Sure.
I feel that first a comment. This Holden village is called a Lutheran retreat center. And when we were down there at the Trappist Monastery, people, of course, asked us, where are you from? And we told them so. And then somebody made the comment and said, hey, do you need a retreat from a retreat center?
We said yes.
And I think, in a sense, there was a lot to be learned down there and a lot to be experienced down there. In terms of silence in particular, in terms of less or fewer activities than we have them around here, which meant for me personally that although nothing really happened in the outside world, a lot came up, and I was able to do a lot of thinking and came up with some new plans. And it's almost like nothing happens in the outside world and still so much happens. It was a very, very rich period of time. Every day was just full of things.
Two things for me. One was the humor. Like, I've talked with a couple people here about the kind of humor. Oftentimes here at Holden, and a lot of the humor I've been involved with, it's kind of at someone's expense. It doesn't dig real deep, but there's always kind of a, it's at someone's expense kind of a humor that we often, at least that I participate in here, with a lot of people. And I was even having some struggles with that in terms of a couple relationships. And I noticed there that their humor is different. There's real humor there, but I haven't really figured it out yet, but the humor was not really at the expense of anything. It was more like just, or at the expense of any particular person. It was more just kind of at the absurdity of life, and the foolishness and naiveness, and but the beauty trying to burst through and stumbling on its feet kind of thing. But I really noticed a real difference in humor, and it's made me much more cautious of the humor. When I joke and laugh and joke with people, or am joking, I'm really checking out what's really what's happening at a deeper level. Is there something? And it's made me much more cautious on humor, and also realizing there's another kind of humor that's really healthy and cleansing, and there's an unhealthy humor. So for me, that was one real revealing thing, I guess, for myself. And another thing was just seeing, authenticity of people. The monks, I still have kind of had this idea of these holy people, you know, kind of thing. And so many people there were very holy, I sense, but just real simple, common folks. And they were not non-pretentious. Thomas Merton, in one of his tapes on the mystical life, talks about you gotta watch out for those really holy people who appear really holy. He says, I don't want to swear, but they are just sons of, they are just P-A-S-T-A-R-D-S, you know, kind of, and he just, and so for me, seeing what really holiness is, it's simple, common, good people, you know, and people who will be nervous, make mistakes, laugh at themselves. So I got really a new, I think, a fresher sense of what holiness is and kind of what the norms are for myself, in a sense. And that was very helpful for me.
As I said, I was awakened to, in my life, to a hunger for prayer, which I'd not experienced before. Also, too, I think I spent some time reflecting on some of the humor that I engage in. That's interesting, Rick, that we both had that experience. And humor can so easily turn into something negative. Also, it's to me, it was very impressive to see a community of people who really were trying to dedicate their lives to knowing and loving God. Something about that touched me very deeply. Here was a group of people who have forsaken a lot, and each one in his own way was struggling, trying to come closer to God and to learn to love God. That affected me rather deeply, I think.
Sorry. I'd be interested in hearing about the one monster you thought was a flake.
I don't know if it's too good to dwell on the negative, but very pretentious, trying to impress us. At least those were my really first impressions of that. And then once I recognized that, I just avoided the person. And that was, I don't know if you'd want to comment on that, but it was not a... just very pretentious and trying to be very impressive. And that was my impression. Do you want to say anything?
How much silence was observed? How was it?
There was no entire silence. You have certain monastic orders where silence is adhered to entirely. And actually, until probably 15 years ago, the Trappists were known for total silence. But then with Vatican II, which took place between 1962 and 65, that was... they ended silence and now do allow talking. But I would say talking is restricted to a minimum. For instance, during work, if you need to know something, you talk. And other than that, if you have difficulties in your spiritual life or in studies, then there's talk there, there's conversation. And of course, between the guest master and the other monks and the guests, there's talking going on there. But yet, always with the idea of not indulging too much in it.
Also, their meals are in silence. And the noon meal, they'll have a reader who's up on a balcony and he'll be reading something, often like Kurt Vonnegut or something really, it's not some holy, you know, Lord all thou, you know, it's real kind of a existential issues that are alive, you know, very penetrating reading. Yeah, it is.
Did you eat in the refectory? Or
no, no, but I just, you know, when I was with the Benedictine monastery, the Trappists, you are not allowed to eat with the Trappists. The Benedictines, at least when I was there, we had lunch and dinner with them. Also, there, in terms of the silence now, also, after the last evening service, there's silence until the next morning. So that's about 10 hours or something like that. You know, it was interesting. I was asking one of the don't remember the monk's name, but he was in charge of the bookstore because I was thinking of buying these Thomas Merton tapes. And he was across the parking lot, and I asked him a question, and he gave me an answer, and he kind of was doing the sign language. And I made a joke. I said, it looks like you're being a cheerleader or something. And he kind of laughed, and he said, but oh yeah, I talk with my hands, because, as Eckhart said, 15 years ago, they had sign language. And they would talk with sign language.
Huh.
And so he was still in the habit of talking with his hands in that sense.
There's such an emphasis on prayer. I wondered how much emphasis there was, like, on the Bible, in Bible reading or Bible study, or is it just for private time, or is just more the emphasis on prayer?
During some of the worships, they do have, or one monk gets up and to read certain passages out of the Bible, and during, what's it called? Forget here, Lord's communion, there's a really brief sermon, not more than 5 minutes.
And
I was there on a Sunday, and two of the brothers led a Bible study for the guests, and I enjoyed that.
And they also sing all the psalms every 2 or 3 weeks. All the psalms are sung.
I don't know. I don't think they go through the whole Psalter.
Don't they?
They have a subset of the Psalter, and they cycle through it.
Okay, maybe
every couple of weeks, I think.
Julia,
I'm missing. Maybe this is an important part of it. Is it all a discussion between the monks, and our ideas are? Does it matter if you're what the other monks in the group are like? I mean, could somebody choose to go to a different monastery because personalities, or is that our personality community? Is it more a God and self thing, or is it more of a, it seems like there isn't any chance for discussion of ideas?
Mm-hmm.
It's all a, you digesting information from the outside, you reading books from the outside, and then your own thing, or, you know,
mm-hmm. We talked about that with Brother Mark. First of all, a monastery is a community of people who are interested in spiritual life, and they get together, and they stick to certain rules, because that helps them individually to seek their way or to seek God. So it's a community of a community with a similar goal, and everyone is on a different journey, and there's no such thing as a compulsory way or path or whatever. Now, as a consequence of that, there are differences, belief differences, or differences in beliefs and in ideas and whatever. And Brother Mark said that once in a while they get together and discuss a few things, but not too often. Of course, you have certain groups that meet and share their ideas.
I wonder how often that was, or how
often. Oh, I don't know exactly.
Yeah, it's not. It's
at
not
least what Brother Mark said, it's not on a regular basis.
Norm.
It's almost as if they try to try to avoid conflicts or confrontations.
Why don't we take a minute? It's been about 35, 40 minutes now. If anybody wants to stay and has some more questions to ask, well, we will stay here for a while longer. But those of you who want to leave can leave. Maybe you've got a couple little booklets here, some pictures and about life of Our Lady of Guadalupe. You might want to take a look at these sometime before you leave. Thank you. Oh, the guest master recommended one book to me in particular. Well, he actually recommended several, but as a primer, this undoubtedly was his favorite, because when I started to read the book, I realized that what he had told me was really, he had committed the major points of that book to heart. And from this author's point of view, who was an abbot of, I believe, of a Cistercian monastery.
What was the name of the book? Right?
It's called The Ways of Mental Prayer by Vitalis Lahoti. I think he's a Frenchman, but I don't know. Vitalis Lahoti. There's something called ordinary mental prayer. And I guess there's something called affective prayer. Or maybe that may also be synonymous with something called the prayer of quiet, and then the highest, quote, highest form of prayer, contemplative prayer. And I guess that ordinary mental prayer, just very roughly, very much involves an effort of your will to fix your attention upon God. This is often done, especially in the beginning. There is a structure that a beginner can and ought to follow, because otherwise you sort of thrash about. You begin with sort of considering a piece of scripture or perhaps one of the spiritual classics, and there are many, The Imitation of Christ, taking a small, you know, just a reading out of that, and thinking about it, turning it over in your mind, and using that as sort of a step ladder to getting your thoughts more directed toward God. And then there are several things you can do after that. But as you ascend the ladder of prayer, somehow by God's grace, essentially, I'm sure, by God's grace, the supernatural part of prayer take on more importance. It becomes less, the will is still there, but instead of you doing all the acting, God is beginning to act upon you. And until finally, in the final stages in contemplative prayer, it's sort of, you really do have this, I guess, a profound sense that you are in communion with God, and a lot of the labors that you had to go through when you were a beginner are unnecessary, because somehow your soul has been tuned to the divine. It's more easily turned to thoughts of God than when you're down here, like where I am, groveling on the floor. That's a very stammering and rough sketch of the progression. Be happy to let you look at the book sometime. There are lots of good books on prayer, I think, and I could give you a short list of the books that the guest master recommended to me. Rick is I think even more conversant in the literature.
Yeah. Are there aspects of their community life that you would like to see incorporated into our community life?
Something that was very surprising for me was that they have a Zendo there, and they've had this Zendo for 15 years. Now, some of you might not know what a Zendo is. Zendo is linked with Zen Buddhism, and it's the room where you sit in. And Thomas Merton has built this bridge between Christianity and Buddhism in particular. And he's written a number of essays about that ecumenism, if you want to, between the Eastern and Western religions, or in particular Christianity and the Eastern religions. And so Zen, or the Zen sitting was incorporated in, or is incorporated in, monastic life at this particular Trappist monastery. And they sit twice a day. One, the first time is at 3:15 in the morning until 4:15, which is very, very early. probably too early for most of us. But then on the other hand, it has the big advantage that it is a really quiet time of the day, a very peaceful time, and the mind is very clear. And I set a number of...
Some mind.
When the wonderful thing, also see, they go to bed at 8 o'clock. 8 o'clock is their standard time to go to sleep.
Yeah.
So quarter after 3 isn't that rough, you know. If you go to bed at 8, if you're used to going to bed at 8 o'clock, that's 7 hours sleep. So, anyway, go ahead.
And I sat a number of times with the monks, and it was always a very, very beneficial thing to do. And then the second time they sit is from 6 to 6:30 p.m. in the afternoon. So that was something I thought was very, very impressive, this incorporation of Eastern techniques. They call it a Christian Zendo. And it's very simple. They just sit for an hour, and then after that, they just say, "Thank be to the Father," and that's it.
Because another thing that I like what they did is the work schedule of 6 4-hour days. There's a lot of difference between a 6-hour day and a 4-hour day. You know, you really have an ability to really develop a lot outside. You know, and I would like to see. You know, in terms of holding, it'd be nice if that somehow the 36 hours could be reduced down to 30 or maybe even a little less than that. I think that would be really helpful in people developing not only spirituality but other things outside, because 36 hours is almost a 40-hour week. And it was really interesting. I thought, I was kind of personally disappointed in the presence, what I perceived as the presence of God in their liturgical service. And I'm kind of trying to work through why in terms of other services I've been in, particularly at Teze and the Benedictine Monastery. But I think much of their presence that they had is they were able to work 4 hours a day, 6 days a week, and that work is very refreshing. That kind of work, and going from 24, say 24 to 40, there's a tremendous difference between 24 and 40. One really becomes the difference between being a free worker to a slave, almost, in a sense. So I would like to see that somehow. It would be nice to have it cut in hours, and I don't know how that could be made up, but I think it could if there was that general consensus by everybody to do that. It's 9:20. Maybe we have one more question and then...
I was just wondering, I don't know how to word it, but do you, you know, when they pray, do they give them a schedule, a schedule of things to pray about? Since they pray all day, then every day, is there prayer requests or...
Well, I think there are prayer requests, but there's really a recognition of the individuality of the walk and the pilgrimage, you know, to our God. And there's a tremendous freedom in that. You know, there's tremendous. I was surprised at the freedom that was allowed within the Trappist monastery, within the structure. I was really surprised at the personal freedom that was allowed there. They have 5 worship services, and there's prayer within every one of those.
So
they spend two hours a day in liturgical prayer.
I just want to say one thing. The way you describe the prayer sounds similar to the way of the pilgrim, the prayer of the heart.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for attending. I think we better wrap it up.
Yeah, that's
how fun the 5 minutes.